Okay, this is the plan. I've done the introduction. I'm going to, in these first four lectures, those who've just arrived haven't missed anything, so there's some seats over there probably. I'm going to give you an overview, just briefly give you the four kinds of theoretical approach in economic anthropology, and then run you through the first of them, the formalist approach, in relation to modes of production, gatherers, tribesmen, peasant industrial. This is a fairly bland overview, because this is what much of economic anthropology was until quite recently, looking at different modes of economic production. It can roughly be divided, the four theoretical frameworks in economic anthropology can roughly be divided into the centuries, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st, and into schools, the formalist, political economy, substantivist, and culturalist. And I'll just explain those terms in case you haven't come across them. When I came back into anthropology, after being away in history for 5 years, people were all talking about formalism and substantivism, and I had to go up secretly to one of my colleagues and say, what is substantivism? So I'm going to explain it if you haven't come across it so far. But I'm going to try and keep off jargon. Any jargon will be explained in the handout. So let's start with formalism. This was basically classical economics. Oh, I meant to ask you who you were. How many of you are SPS people? Four of you. Okay. Any anthropologists? Archaeanthropologists. Oh, yes, some of you. And about a third of you will be, of those will be archaeologists and a third and so on. Okay. Anyone else? Anyone from any other? Any mafia? Any CIA? No? Okay. You wouldn't tell me anyway. Right. Formalists. This is invented, well, this is simplified, Adam Smith and Montesquieu. I've written the names of people who I refer to up here for the spelling there. Let's take Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, 1776. He laid out the platform of classical economics and simplifying him down to two ideas. The first is that societies go through different modes of production. There are four stages of civilization, basically what modern anthropologists will call hunters and gatherers and tribesmen, which is the first stage, peasant societies, and in fact he really takes those first three because of course industrialism hadn't come along. So he basically divides the world into modes of production. This was an idea that came out of Montesquieu and Condorcet and others. And it's the underpinning of classical economics. There are different modes of creating and producing wealth, which use different technologies, and they evolve from one to the other. For him, actually, it was hunter-gatherer, pastoralist, sort of Highland Scots, settled civilization, a settled agriculturalist, and commercial society, which is as far as it had got at that time. And this is related to population densities, technologies, and other things like that. That's one framework. That's the framework I'll be using in this lecture. The second is his famous idea about human motivation. He was a philosopher, as you know, wrote on moral sentiments, and he said that human beings are driven by two basic drives. One is cooperative collaboration, and one is competitive individualism, simplifying it somewhat. So he put forward the idea of homo economicus, that human beings are maximizing individuals. In perhaps the most famous description of this in the beginning of The Wealth of Nations, he says that the growth of wealth and the division of labour is the consequence, and I quote here, of a certain propensity in human nature to truck, that's exchange, barter, another kind of exchange, and exchange one thing for another. We are like school children in a playground. We like swapping things and making a little bit of profit on the way. So the economy is driven not by nice feelings. He said, you can't run an economy on the basis of human warmth and love, but on the basis that we are competitive, games-playing species. We're just a species of animal that likes doing that. His famous description of that, and this will be the last quote from Adam Smith, is, "It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their own advantages. If we can persuade them, and money is a form of persuasion, that it's in their interest to give us something, then they'll do it. You can't say be kind and nice." So this paradigm, the formalist paradigm, is summarized by Christopher Hann, whose work is recommended for your reading. It's a very good overview of economic anthropology. He used to give lectures here for many years. He describes the formalist paradigm as the formalist or decision-taking approach. It amounts essentially to the generalization of the modern economist toolkit to the entire range of human societies. The fundamental axioms of neoclassical and classical economics are scarcity and utility maximizing. Things are scarce, you try and increase utility to yourself. The constraints within which economic actors make their decisions obviously differ from case to case. However, formalists, and they're a kind of economic anthropologists, at a certain level of abstraction, it is assumed that African pastoralists, Australian hunter-gatherers, and European capitalist firms all make choices in fundamentally the same way in order to maximise utilities given the information available to them. You're rational, you want to make a profit. And that's true of a hunter-gatherer or anyone. Same basic model. That is the underpinning of formalism, and I'll talk further about that later. The second approach is political economy approach, which is the 19th century, and obviously the person who is here, the nominating figure, is Karl Marx. Here, the economy, in the last instance, determines the modes of production. It isn't technology and a changing way of producing wealth. It is, famously, the relations of production, how people have a share and organise the production of wealth that determines everything. As he puts it, and this is the one quote from Marx, the economic structure of society is the real basis on which the juridical and political superstructure is raised, and to which definitive forms of social thought correspond. In short, the mode of production determines the character of the social, political, and intellectual life generally. So that is the approach of political economy. Politics comes really before economics. And that is the 19th century approach, which I'll be illustrating and discussing next week when I talk about property. Moving on to the 20th century, as anthropologists and others studied many societies, they discovered that the basic premise of Western economics doesn't seem to apply, it doesn't work. It isn't true that New Guinea Highlanders or Australian hunter-gatherers are maximising in the same way. And so a new way of looking at economics in these societies was developed, which was called substantivism. And the key figure around whom this developed was the economic anthropologist Karl Polanyi, who's on the reading list there. He and others pointed out that there are two senses of the word economic. There's the formalist, which I've mentioned, maximising utility in conditions of scarcity. However, in the substantive or substance sense, economics was simply the study of how humans obtained a living from their environment. And this varies. You have to go inside the society to see how they do that. So while Western capitalist societies, in which the theories of economics were developed by Smith and others, are susceptible and work quite well with a formalist model, in pre-industrial, non-capitalist societies, the major tools which hold the economy together are not maximising rational individual choice, but reciprocity and redistribution. So they turned, these substantivists turned to internalist, to looking at each economy within its own rights. And one quote from Polanyi to give you an example of what he's thinking about. The format of the substantive concept is the empirical economy, the actual existing economy. It can be briefly defined as an instituted process of interaction between man and his environment, which results in a continuous supply of want-satisfying material means. So it's human beings in relation to their environment. Now, the instituted process I'll come back to later, because that was one of his greatest findings, was that only in capitalism really do you get the economy disembedded, that was another of his famous phrases, taken out of the rest of social relations and turned into an institution or an instituted process. You don't find the Hong Kong exchange market present in Highland New Guinea. You don't have instituted stock markets and banks and all the institutions of modern economies. Nothing is instituted at all, in fact, as you'll see. And I'll talk about that in relation to perhaps the greatest anthropological thinker in relation to this, which is, I haven't put up, but is Marcel Mauss, M-A-U, nevertheless, in relation to the gift. And finally, moving to the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century, you have culturalism, looking at the culture of the economy, looking at how people feel, how they consume. It's much more about consumption than about production or distribution. And you need to study local models of the people and see what they feel about. I mean, take a famous example. Daniel Miller, as spelled normally, studied housewives buying practices on a North London road or a London road. What do people think they're doing when they're shopping in Sainsbury's? Well, I have no idea what I think I'm doing when I shop in Sainsbury's, or I should say Tesco, just to set your mind at rest about my social class. But anyway, wherever I shop, I have no idea. My wife has given me a list. But anyway, he had theories that people were doing much more than we thought they were doing. So that's the kind of thing that, and I'll talk to you then about that in the last lecture. So let's now move on to a look at the different stages of modes of production. Hunters and gatherers. As you know, and all hunter-gatherer people are keen to tell you, 90% of the people who lived on Earth have been hunters and gatherers. Maybe getting down now, but that was true in the 70s. Because they were around for such a long time. There were very few of them, but they were around for 100,000 years and it just added up. Recently they've been pushed to marginal areas of the world, of course. Deserts, Arctic, tundra, forests and so on, and there are very few left. And they are symbiotic, obviously, with settled peoples. But they tell us quite a lot about the early condition of human beings, and particularly the archaeologists among you will be interested in how they work. Here are just a few features of them. You may notice that a very helpful distinction was made by James Whitburn between two kinds of hunter-gatherer.
what he calls immediate return hunter-gatherers. These are the people he studied in Africa, the Hadza, H-A-D-A-Z-A. They basically went out and hunted, came back, killed the animal, and shared it. They didn't store it, they didn't keep it. And it was very, very immediate distribution. And these are the simplest hunter-gatherer bands in Australia and Africa and so on. There's another kind who are the delayed return. They're like the Eskimos and Northwest American Indians who have storage devices, often because it's a cold climate and you can put away the oil and the furs and so on, and you keep it for a while. And this allows a certain accumulation of wealth, and these societies have much more tend to have some stratification than big men and potlatches and things I'll tell you about later. And I always find that a very helpful distinction of two kinds of hunter-gatherer. But basically, all of them have certain things in common. One is that they extract their food from nature. They hunt and gather across the surface. They harvest nature rather than cultivating plants. Much of my description will actually fit me pretty well. When I go to Sainsbury's, as you can see on a film on my website if you want, I go around Sainsbury's rushing around. They filmed it for Channel 4. I wasn't the person rushing around, but someone was. Just hunting and gathering. We live like that. We skim across, not nature of course, but artificially produced goods, but that's how hunters and gatherers do. They don't actually go out into the fields and produce anything. They skim nature. And that was what most of human existence was, skimming nature like that. So if you have pets and beehives and things like that, there are always exceptions, little exceptions, but that's the main mode. They're nomadic, there's high mobility, they don't stay in one place. Light shelters, they forage around the place. Men and women characteristically forage and do things separately. You've probably heard man the hunter, woman the gatherer. And in fact, it's the women, as usual, who do most of the useful work. Something like 60 to 70% comes from the women's foraging, and the men have a good time hunting, but aren't so useful. I'm aiming all this at the fact that I think the larger proportion of you are women, so I'm trying to win your vote constantly. The men don't be impressed by this. The bands are very fluid, usually very small, about 25 to 30, and if you don't like it, a band, you clear off and go somewhere else, you vote with your feet. This makes it impossible really to have a, as I'll go into, remember some of this for the politics lectures, because I'll be going over this in another way, looking at it from a political framework. But it makes it very difficult to have chiefs in this situation. The work is very light. The old idea that these societies were oppressed in their work because it's so difficult to... There's no one else around. They have the whole world at this time. These aren't modern hunters and gatherers. And it's a sort of Garden of Eden where you can, in 1 to 3 hours maximum a day, once or twice a week you might go hunting and the rest of the time you're foraging. Very light work. And so there's a lot of time sitting around. James Woodburn describes how they sit around for most of the time gambling. But nothing, they don't pay any money, but they just play games. And there's a lot of food sharing. There are various other features of them. There's usually controlled fertility to stop the bands growing too large. And the population density is very low. So, moving on to tribesmen. You're talking now about the strange move, which no one has ever explained really, to people producing wealth, not just skimming across the surface. It's one of the two great transitions, economic transitions in human history, from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic. People are beginning to now use tools and technologies to produce wealth. Something like, well, it's been pushed back by archaeologists a lot. It used to be thought to be about 10,000 years ago, but it's now a much more gradual process. But the basic feature of tribesmen is they produce the food rather than just harvesting it. And they do it in two main ways, through the domestication of crops. And these are horticulturalists. and through the domestication of animals, the pastoralists, sometimes obviously they do both together, like New Guinea hyenas, who traditionally do yams and pigs at the same time. But analytically, you can separate those two names. The general features of these societies still relatively light work, seasonal bursts, quite a lot of leisure. These are the societies that are now much larger, and they're dominated by kinship and by ritual. They're the main hunting ground for traditional anthropologists. And nothing can be separated. The best single book introduction to tribesmen, I think, is still by Marshall Sardines, whose name is called Tribesmen. And basically here are undivided worlds where religion, politics, kinship and economics are all fused together. But still, there is no state, there's no writing, all these things which we call roughly and jokingly civilization have not yet emerged. That's the tribal. The horticulturalists have huge exchange systems, multi-cropping systems. There's very high productivity per man hour, and therefore, as I mentioned, not too much work. And these are the people who tend to live in the great forests of Amazonia, Central Africa, Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. Those are the horticultural tribal peoples. And then the pastoralists keep various livestock, cattle, sheep, goats, so on. And roughly, interestingly, there's a sort of band of them. You start in Northeast Africa, Ethiopia, Sudan, and then you go up through the Middle East, and then you go through Central Asia, up to Siberia. And that, if you imagine that arc or crescent, those are the great pastoral societies. Here you have different consequences. There's a division of labour according to sex, much more. Men herd the animals, women do the milking and other things. There's a very close attachment to animals in such societies. And most of these societies are seasonally nomadic, moving with their herds over large territories. These are high protein diets in these societies because it's mainly milk and meat and blood. The social structure is now getting more complex, and these are the great societies which have age grades, as in East Africa, dividing population into age grades. And they are very warlike societies. Tribal societies, as Sardines points out, are the great warfare or feuding societies. Pastoralists guard their crops. Pastoralists guard their herds against marauders, and there's a feud is characteristic of these societies, and a different kind of fighting is characteristic of many of the forest peoples, but I'll come back to that when I talk about war. Peasants, roughly what we call civilization, i.e. tools, written languages, the state, and so on, started about 6,000 years ago. And basically, what is meant by peasants, and again, the little old book by Eric Wolff called Peasants is quite a good introduction to peasants. Basically, what you mean by peasants are the people who live in the countryside as part societies. That was the famous phrase. They are part, in other words, they are not complete in themselves. They pay taxes to other people. They are governed by other people. I'm just watching the cult movie film Lagan, which some of you may have seen, about how an Indian village took on the British Raj in cricket and beat them. I haven't quite got to them beating them yet. But anyway, here was a peasant village paying taxes. Lagan means taxes to the British. They're sweating away in the fields, they're illiterate, and they're challenged, and they beat the British at cricket, and their taxes go, I hope. But that's basically what peasantry are. You're now in a situation with a number of other features. Very hard work. The history of human society has been the enslavement of human beings. If you look at the hard work that was carried out in traditional peasantries and still is in India, China, Japan and so on, immensely hard work. You're talking of anything between 8 and 15 hours a day, most days of the year, but then suddenly a festival or whatever, but very hard work. The basic unit of production now is the household, the extended household rather than the tribe. There's now a very strong emotional link between the land and the family. The peasants are desperately dependent on land and they try not to sell it. They keep the name on the land, as the Irish put it. Production in the village is mainly for local use, though you have to produce these surpluses for ritual purposes like marriages and so on, and also for taxes. Within the village there's little market rationality, that is, production is not mainly for exchange, but outside you've got to deal with landlords and others. The fertility rate in these societies is usually traditionally high, but then, as I'll explain elsewhere, usually you have some disaster which cuts a swathe through the population. There are part societies in relation to the state. There are states and there are literati, there are priests, there are rulers. So that is the nature of these peasant civilizations. And remember that, although it now may seem a long time to you, this was the world until in England it changed about between 1780 and 1850. Industrialization and the destruction of the peasantry in the rest of Europe and the rest of the world only really happened after 1840-50. It's 150 years since the world switched, the rest of the world apart from England switched, America and Europe and Japan and then later others. So peasants produce much of the literature, peasant civilizations, the literature, the ways of doing things that we still inhabit. Now, at this point, I always quote this to people I haven't lectured to, though I may have lectured to, I won't have lectured to any of you, but I was very impressed when I was an undergraduate by a social psychologist who said that the attention span of students in lectures was about 30 minutes, 35 minutes. After that, it's pure waste of time. Now, we're stuck with an hour, so probably I've told you most of what I'm going to tell you. But you have to sit here, because otherwise what would you do in the next quarter of an hour? So, what would I do? So, what I'm going to do in each lecture is to take you, use the facilities here, which for the first time really, I hope, will work and are good, just to take you into further materials which you can explore yourselves. The lecture is just a taster. Most of the materials I'd like you to think about are on my website, and if you'd be interested in following up things, watching films and so on, and hearing other things, then you can go there. So I'm going to, each lecture I'll give you 5 minutes or so break. This is when you don't have to take notes, you don't have to concentrate, you just have to enjoy, as they say. On www.alanmcfarlane.com, I'm not a .com, still there should be a .org, but anyway, or something. But not those of the old days when it looked fashionable to be a .com, so I've got this name. On this name, you'll find this. And I'm going to go through different parts of it in each lecture to show you what's there, just for 5 minutes. So here I'm going to show you what's under lectures. The main thing that will interest most of you is the first bit here, I hope, which is a little talk I gave really for a 14-year-old school girl who got in touch with me and said, what is social anthropology? So I tried to tell her in simple terms. It's what I gave to school neighbours who are thinking of coming to Cambridge just as an informal talk. So it's what I think social anthropology is. This is the full version of what you'll get as behind this on the reading list here. I just went through 6 or 5 anthropology textbooks, took out all the useful words and the useful definitions, and joined them together. The acknowledgements are at the end of this. It's a PDF you can print off. And it might be something useful to take around with you, because when someone says alliance systems, or agnatic, or anomie, or whatever it is, an action group, or acephalous society, and you're confused, you can look and see whether there's a definition and description. And it is actually also a vague introduction to anthropology, because it makes a lot of distinctions. So postmodernism, or theories of the state, there is a very, maybe 2 or 3 lines, a succinct summary. So you can print that off if it's useful for you. Um, over the years, I've given a number of courses, basic anthropology courses. This is a course I gave between 1975 and 1981, and when I finished it, I thought I might as well film it. So I look very young, but it's something which you won't get now. We've given up giving that kind of course, but it basically explains what kinship is. It's 10-20 minute introduction, so as you can see, why it's important, natural and your descent systems, what is inheritance, what does descent mean, economics and marriage, bride, birth and dowry. So all these are talks by another man who looks vaguely like me.
In this talk, I want to look at the economics, sociology and demography of marriage. The transfer of wealth at marriage is of ultimate importance in most societies. Among the Trobriands, for example, we're told by another Mosky, instead of having to buy his wife, the man receives a dowry, often relatively as tempting as that of a modern European or American heiress. This fact makes marriage among the Trobrianders a pivot of the constitution of tribal power and in the whole economic system, a pivot indeed in almost every institution. Among the Nura, the payment or receipt,
and so on. So they're all there, and you can watch them. I will, my webmistress, as well as my mistress and also my wife, is it always sounds a bit odd talking about your wife as a webmistress, but anyway, I'll ask whether she can set this up as a downloadable thing, so you can put it on your computer and look at it in your own time, which is a feature of almost everything else on my website, as you'll see. This is actually coming off the internet. It's the first time I've managed to get a lecture room where I can get stuff actually off. So this is in real time. And I shouldn't really show you this, but as you've seen, you could have come to these lectures electronically. What I did last year was I didn't know that I was going to give them again. So I didn't get them filmed, but I just sat down in my tea house at home and spoke them. I don't think, actually, you would get the same frisson watching them that way, but if you miss one, a sort of version is there, okay? There's no visuals and so on, so if you miss one, have a look at that. And also, last year, Stephen Hugh Jones gave his celebrated lectures on the symbolic and the real for the last time, and he kindly allowed us, it was filmed by this Wang here, and we put them on last week. So here you can go to, they'll probably be different from whatever you got this year. Stephen was particularly good on animals, and so you can watch another version of...
Okay, why animals? Well, there are all sorts of reasons why human beings are interested in animals, and I'll just skim through them briefly. One of them is, of course, that we live with animals and interact with animals. And one of the, one of the points I want to talk about in a minute is the difference, the way in which we have actually, in some ways, become alienated.
And so on. So you can see those if you'd like. If any of you are interested in what anthropologists actually do, there's, or for instance, if you're SPS, those classical theory ones, which you won't get because they're given in our second year, I give 8 lectures, one on Marx, one on Durkheim, one on Weber, and other famous figures. You might or might not find those helpful. And also an overview of changing paradigms in the social sciences. But if you want to see what an anthropologist does, then on doing fieldwork, as far as I know, is the only film in the world has ever been made about someone actually doing anthropological fieldwork. Strange. Certainly the only one on the web. It's very badly edited, well, roughly edited and old, and it was filmed by my wife in the Himalayas, in the village I work with, in the Annapurna Mountains, over a period of about 10 years. Just little bits about what an anthropologist does, so if you're interested in finding out more, that's that. Okay.
I said I would end at 10:02, so just in the last 2 or 3 minutes, each week, as I say, I'll show you different bits. The last 2 or 3 minutes, just like to deal with industrial societies. You don't really need to be told about this if you live in them, but they start off badly, too much work, the Industrial Revolution, what's happening in China, etc., etc. Huge amount of work. Then, supposedly, the machine takes the strain and the work load goes down and you have knowledge economies. The concentration of wealth becomes more and more uneven, as Marx pointed out, wealth into fewer hands. They've moved now from peasant societies where money and markets are peripheral to most people's lives to one where they're dominant. And they've moved to ones where property is owned, as I'll explain next week, not by families and households, but by individuals. Obviously, the central feature is that machinery replaces human labour in these, and they are basically can be described as carbon energy-based civilizations. In other words, we're living off not the current account of energy from the sun through translation through animals and plants, as peasants and everyone else have done, but through the stored up, inherited good fortune of fossil fuels. And how long we can go on doing that, as you know, is a question. And the other feature of these civilizations is that they're highly urbanized. I think this year, for the first time, the majority of the human population now lives in cities, depending on how you define a city, of course, but cities are growing at a huge growth rate, and the creative rural folk is nearly over. And they're characterized by high social and geographical mobility. And of course, it has political and other ramifications which I'll come into. So that is the structure. I always used to teach with that structure in mind, those four kinds of civilization. Of course, it's unfashionable to do so now, and it's not a necessary evolution, but I think it may be useful as an underpinning for you to think in terms of those four kinds of society and keep that in the back of your mind. So look forward to seeing, I hope, a lot of you on, what's the day? Friday, Tuesday. Okay, thank you very much.